يا ليل ما أطولك، مشيتني حافي.
All of us have dedicated our lives to the same hopes and dreams. We all stand for social justice and liberation in this country. The same way my people have dedicated their lives to the liberation of Palestine. Palestinian women are looking to this conference for your continued support of our rights, freedom, for Palestinian political prisoners, the right of return, self-determination, and independence, and one single liberated state where everyone is equal.
Rasmia O'Day is the Associate Director of the Arab American Action Network in Chicago. She has been a long-standing advocate for justice since her youth in Palestine, where she was imprisoned and brutally tortured by the Israeli government. Rasmia has been an American citizen since the mid-90s and has served the Arab community in Chicago for over 20 years. She is a beloved member of the international Palestinian community and has served as a mentor to many. On October 22, 2013, then 65-year-old Rasmia was arrested in her home by the FBI as a part of a larger, politically charged witch hunt to silence Palestinian leaders, anti-war, and international solidarity activists. Rasmia was charged with unlawful procurement of naturalization and denied a full and fair trial, which led to her conviction this past November. She now faces time in federal prison and deportation to Jordan. Radio Autonomia was fortunate enough to catch up with Muhammad, a youth organizer from the Arab American Action Network, during the Color of Violence conference in Chicago this past March, where Rasmia was a keynote speaker.
Arab American Action Network, or AAAN, as we kind of colloquially call it. The mission of our organization is really to help the Arab community empower itself, to really be agents in policies and things that happen in their own lives that really directly affect them. And the work that we do, we have this model where we bridge social services and community organizing together as a model for social change. And so we believe that simply helping people find direct services, food stamps, medical assistance, healthcare, ESL classes, citizenship assistance, that's good, and those are necessary, like immediate needs, but they don't solve any of the structural issues that we have, right? And so then we sort of pair that with our community organizing model, which then organizes and centers people who are most affected by these policies that affect the Arab community, low-income, working-class Arab people, at the center of our work as a way for them to be agents of change for these structural policies. So what does that mean in a practical term? Our social services department provides, again, like food stamps, help with Obamacare, medical cards, medical assistance, ESL classes, citizenship classes, and we also have a youth services department that does homework help for K through 8. And then our organizing wing is the youth organizing program, which I personally work in, and that's high schoolers age 14 to 18, 14 to 19-ish. Then Rasmia's work, which is the Arab Women's Committee, which is a base of 600 to 700 women in the community, mostly immigrants. And again, it's about political education and about community organizing and centering them to try to change and organize around policies.
So you talked a little bit about Rasmia's work. Can you elaborate a little bit more about some of the specifics of her organizing efforts?
Yeah. So the Arab Women's Committee, which is Rasmia's organizing project, just to give a little bit of history, it actually started with Rasmia. So Rasmia's, you know, she's been organizing for a long time, and she does it the old school way. And so she opened up the phone book and looked up all the last names that began with that sounded like they were Arabic, and then called people and said, "Hi, my name's Rasmiya. I'd like to have a cup of coffee with you."
Wow.
And she started meeting women this way. And she said, she started to say, there are all of these women, and we face these really unique challenges as being Arab women, recent immigrant women, many of us refugees in the United States. Why don't we create a space for us, first, to talk about these things, and then, two, to act on some of our challenges. And so her work is, it's hard to really encapsulate, but it can range from, they do writing activities where these women are given skills to help write their life stories. They do education activities, which not only is political education, but also sort of like social and cultural awareness for women in the United States. So an example of that is they brought in a Palestinian woman who works as a drug counselor to talk about signs of drug use and abuse in youth and how to recognize it and really how to deal with it in a productive manner. So that's sort of like, that can be the education aspect. And the third one is really not only the political education, but the political work that gets women to organize for things like immigrant rights, refugee services from the state, like to combat funding cuts for refugee services in the state, to be able to advocate for other families that need assistance, state assistance, or things like that. And a way that's really, again, you know, like amplifying the voice of these Arab women as agents in their own lives.
In a nutshell, can you talk about what happened to Rasmiya?
Yeah, so in October 2013, Rasmiya was visited by the Department of Homeland Security and the FBI, and they arrested her in the morning and took her downtown in Chicago to federal lockup. And that same day, she was charged with what's called unlawful procurement of naturalization. So what they're alleging is that, you know, she became a naturalized citizen illegally, quote unquote. And all of this stems from a conviction by the state of Israel in 1969, in which she was held in Israel, tortured really unspeakably for 21 days, including sexual torture, physical, psychological, emotional torture, and then signed a confession and was put in front of a military court, found guilty, of course, and in the military courts, 99.7% of all Palestinians are found guilty. So it's a military occupation court where the judge is an Israeli military person. Everybody is an Israeli military person. She was found guilty. She was put in prison for 10 years and then released in a prisoner exchange. To fast forward a little bit, then she came to the United States in the early 90s. And then in 2004, she became a naturalized citizen. So she went, got her naturalization, became a citizen in the United States. And on the during the naturalization question, they ask, have you been imprisoned? And Rasmiya had been living in the country for 10 years at the time. And understood the question to mean, have you been imprisoned in the United States? And so she answered no. And her past is, meaning, you know, what the Israelis had done and what she went through from the state of Israel is a matter of public record internationally. She testified in the United Nations. You know, the U.S. Embassy, her father was a U.S. citizen at the time this happened to her. So the U.S. Embassy was informed of what had happened to her. And so none of it was hidden. And then when she, sorry, we're kind of jumping a little bit back and forth here. But then when she then went through the naturalization process, then the government said, you intentionally lied on this application to try to hide your past so that you would be able to get naturalization. And that was the charge that they gave her when she was arrested in 2013. And I don't know if you want me to kind of go through the whole, like what happened with the case up until this point now, or if we want to come back to that.
We can go back to it.
Okay, cool. So that's the background then, yeah.
Do you think Rasmiya's case is a byproduct of the anti-war 23 case?
Yeah, so the Midwest 23 case, or the anti-war 23 case, has an interesting connection to Rasmiya's, because a few of the people who were raided or subpoenaed in that case are colleagues or friends of Rasmiya, One of them being Hatem Abudaya, who's the executive director at the Arab American Action Network. Rasmi is the associate director. And we believe that the United States government in this, like, you know, fishing expedition, as we call it, that they looked into these 23 people, Hatem being one of them, they then came across Rasmiya and just started digging to try to find anything, right? And reached out to the Israeli government and said, help us send all these documents from Rasmiya's prosecution in the state of Israel. And the FBI worked with the Israeli government to procure those documents and then used it to kind of weave this tale that, you know, she had lied on her immigration application. So there is, you know, there's a correlation, right? There's a correlation between the two things at that level.
Is government repression deterring political activism in Chicago, or is it having the opposite effect as people mobilize around Rasmiya's case?
Yeah, that's a really good question. y'all are good at your job. I think that it's sort of double-edged. There's a reality, and I think we kind of have to speak it, that there's a reality of the fear that kind of comes with seeing a very public, visible figure in the community be attacked and be criminalized and put on trial. And I think that, you know, it's intentional. It's to try to send this chilling, rippling effect throughout the community of, like, hey, you all shut up, you know, stop what you're doing. But in the same right, I think, and a lot of this, I would give credit to Rasmiya personally as a person, to see Rasmiya really withstand, like, the brunt of the United States federal government's attack against her and her people, and to be able to, like, withstand that the way that she does and how she carries herself, I think, has an effect to really empower and mobilize people to say that, you know, if Rasmiya can stand up, we can all stand with her, you know? And then also the fact that she's an icon. She's been an icon for decades. And she's dedicated really her entire life to her people, both while she was in Palestine and Lebanon and Jordan and while she's been in the United States. And so the reality then is that, like, all of these people whose lives she's affected and touched are going to stand with her as well. And so if I could say, I don't think the government hedged their bets correctly this time in terms of, you know, they may have thought that this would be another case that they were able to, you know, be done with quickly. You know, we pushed back pretty hard.
How can people of color and third world folks draw resilience in moments of intense state repression? And how can we resist scapegoating and or not allow state to divide and conquer?
Oh, that's a good... Wow. So I think that to try to make it in a real tangible sense, I think that cases like Rasmiya's make some things really visible for us. There's some, you know, people talk a lot about intersectionality, right? And intersectionality and ideas and whatever, right? But that the arms of repression are very intersectional as well. And so, you know, the repression that each of different communities face, communities of color, oppressed nationalities in this country face, is different. It's markedly different. For example, you know, mass incarceration does not affect Arabs and Palestinians. There's not a large percentage of Arabs and Palestinians, you know, filling prisons in this country. That being said, though, the system of mass incarceration that incarcerates blacks and Latinos in this country is connected directly to the arm of repression that affects Arabs and South Asians and Muslims, which is the national security apparatus. And those things actually feed into each other. And to give a concrete example again, is that, you know, when police are given military equipment in Ferguson, in Chicago, in all over the country now, when police are given military equipment, it's under the guise of fighting terror, under the guise of fighting terrorism. And so the face of terrorism is our community, the Arab community, the Palestinian community, right? But what does it mean materially when the police are given these things? It does not mean that, you know, they're driving tanks in the small pockets of Arab communities across the United States. It means that they're driving tanks inside of black communities, right? And so we see then like the policing and the militarization that's unleashed on the people in Ferguson, for example, is enabled under this guise of fighting terrorism, but affects a substantially different community than what's the face of terrorism, quote unquote. So when we understand sort of how the arms of repression work, I think that it gives us a lens to understand how our work then to counteract that has to be. And so, you know, we do our work and Rasmiya does her work with an intentionality of saying, like, there's this large kind of puzzle, right? And we're one piece of it. But while we're working on changing this one piece of this puzzle, we have to keep this lens of this larger issue, this larger idea of how we still are connected to all these other pieces. And I also say that, you know, there are some amazingly principled organizers from across different communities who have stood with Rasmiya. And, you know, Rasmiya has stood with other people's struggles as well. One of the things she said when the verdict was handed down, when she was first read the guilty verdict and all her supporters were outside and everybody was crying and it was, you know, this big kind of like mess. But she was really kind of like calm and reserved. And she said, I had spoken to her and she said it to me and a few others who were standing around. And she said, in a country in which these courts were used to imprison the Puerto Rican liberation fighters and the Black Liberation Movement and the Chicano Liberation Movement, why do you think they would give a Palestinian any better treatment? And so it was an understanding in terms of, like, how does the system of this criminal justice system, quote-unquote, work and function? And so, again, just to return to the point, like, I think when we have that lens of understanding of how we're each affected, right, materially differently, and it's not the same oppression, and it's not the same way, but it's all part of kind of the same web and the same puzzle, and it's about how we change those pieces that are affecting us.
Going back to specifically Rasmiya's case and kind of the mobilization that has happened around her, what has been kind of one Rasmiya's like actions around? I know she's very limited around the legalities of what she can say and things like that. So has Rasmiya been able to have a say in any of the actions on her behalf, and are there any accountability processes in place on how to move forward with the things that the mobilizations that folks have done on her behalf? And is she consulted? Like, just what does that look like?
Yeah, so, you know, the Rasmiya Defense Committee, what we kind of call it nationally, obviously is housed sort of in Chicago, right? The people who are closest to her and the people who folks across the country connect with, we're located here in Chicago. And I can say with 100% confidence that nothing from the first day when she was arrested until this moment we're sitting on this table has happened without Rasmiya's knowledge and consent. Locally we meet once every 2 weeks, and Rasmiya is in those meetings with us. And, you know, people have personal relationships with Rasmiya outside of these meetings, and she's consistently consulted, and she's part of the strategic decision-making as well. And so nothing's being done really on behalf of her, you know, nothing about us without us, right? That's sort of the motto we have in the defense work that we're doing. She's consulted on everything, and, you know, nothing's done that would make her uncomfortable, or if she brings up, you know, something that she doesn't want done, it's scrapped, and it's really as simple as that. And then also, you know, that's just that she plays that role where we have to keep in mind that when we're advocating on behalf of somebody, that their voice is ultimately the most important in that process. So
Rasmiya recently spoke at the Insight Color of Violence conference. The theme of the conference was Beyond the State, Inciting Transformative Possibilities. What does it mean to center the lives of immigrant women and trans people in anti-imperialist organizing?
So for her work, what that means is she's organizing amongst Arab immigrant women who are recent immigrants, who are, you know, at best low-income working class, and many of whom are refugees. And for her to center organizing work around these people in a way that it's actually accountable to their needs really provides us with a model and a vision for what does it mean to do like the broader question of anti-imperialist work by centering those voices. So what I mean by that is when you make the theory or the broader political idea of anti-imperialism practical, you have to talk about whose lives does it affect and how. And, you know, I think we'd all be in agreement by saying that, like, immigrant women and then women of oppressed nationalities in their home countries who are low income, right, who become refugees, those are probably the most affected. And so to keep that in mind when we do our political organizing then gives us sort of a handbook of how do we do this then in practical terms. Or when we do our community organizing, gives us a handbook for how do we do it in practical terms when we talk about kind of the broader political issues of anti-imperialism. And so it's what does it mean in very practical terms is that the political work and the community work that you do has to have a direct effect and a direct consequence. I don't mean that necessarily in a negative way, a direct positive consequence in the lives of these people. And so sometimes it means that you view things in a very kind of like practical, local, immediate kind of view, while again having this long vision that we could call anti-imperialist or other things. And I think that that's kind of the model. That's the model that Resmia would use and has kind of taught us. And we replicate in our youth program. But she definitely, you know, focuses it on women in her work.
What have been the ways that the community has resisted in the face of state repression against Resmia and the anti-war 23?
Yeah. So I think the first has been that all of the court mobilizations, so for all of the trial dates, all of the hearings, the sentencing, all of it, really from day one, every time Resmia had a court appearance, we mobilized the community. And, of course, there are, like, activists and people who are a little bit more free to do that kind of political work, right? But the majority of the courtroom, every single day of her trial, was actually packed with the immigrant women that Resmia works with on a daily basis. And these are people who left their families and left their work and left their responsibilities to, you know, drive 5 hours, oftentimes in uncomfortable conditions, or left their families for a week at a time, to be able to support Resmia very visibly. And I think that was one of the most powerful things that I was able to see. Another way, or another piece of that, is that we wrote letters to the judge once when the verdict was first given and she was found guilty. The judge then decided to lock her up, and we had this large letter campaign and call-in campaign, the letters to the judge and the call-in to the jail, in which hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of community members again wrote letters to the judge asking him to release Resmia, which we eventually got. We got her released. And then before the sentencing, we again got hundreds of letters, not only from community members, but also from religious leaders, political leaders. For example, we had a bishop, a former bishop from the Catholic Church in the Michigan area. So really across sectors of society, write to the judge and ask him for leniency in Resmia's sentencing. And he said multiple times throughout the sentencing that he acknowledged that he received a huge outpouring of support from the community, and that, we believe, very much heavily affected the outcome. The prosecution in the case was asking for 5 to 7 years of federal prison time, in addition to deportation. And the judge ended up giving her 18 months of prison, which, of course, you know, we don't believe she should spend a single second in prison. But to give 18 months when the government was asking for 7 years is actually a pretty big victory. And that's, you know, we strongly believe that was because the mass mobilization of people and the mass mobilization for actions that we did in support of Resmia really showed that she had this broad ranging support and she wasn't isolated, and they couldn't just throw her away, you know, or lock her up, throw away the key, and no one would say anything about it.
Just a follow-up question in regards to some of the action, like the ways in which the state actually targeted her, Razmiya spoke a little bit about this experience while at the conference, but she talked about being in isolation and the effects that that has on her, on the body. And so I'm wondering if you can share, maybe speak a little bit about what it means for someone like Razmiya to be placed into isolation in the context of a broader movement against the kind of the shoe, the solitary confinement that that prisoners are leading in the United States. I'm wondering if there was any connection there.
Yeah, I think that on one level it was that there are maybe people who supported Razmiya who aren't connected to maybe broader issues of prison abolition or even, you know, the lesser, like, prisoner rights type things, right? And I think that seeing and following Razmiya's case and seeing her go through that has woken people up to those issues. And again, it's because that Razmiya herself was very intentional about making those connections and saying that, like, when she got out, she began to tell people, like, we need to understand what prison means in this country, right? That that it's a system that destroys people's humanity. And so any of my supporters who think that, you know, prison rehabilitates people or prison is a punishment for people, you know, essentially I don't want you to think that, right? That's not what it is. It's not that I'm a good person and shouldn't go there and bad people should go there. She's really making a broader critique, which is that, like, this is an intentional system that destroys the human being at its core. And that was, from my understanding, some of her talk on at the Insight Conference. And so, you know, that aspect of it, again, then, like, broadens this idea of challenging prisons and challenging the use of isolation to people who weren't necessarily involved in that work. And then on a parallel level, you know, some of us who are more involved in different political realms then are able to have, again, like a tangible example, a tangible experience to refer to a person that we know and care about when we're trying to make connections with people as well. And so I think that, you know, it again, it's like kind of the piece of the puzzle, right? That, like, it's understanding Razmiya's case in this broader context. And when we're able to do that, we're able to draw connections to people who are doing work against isolation or prison abolition work, or other work like that.
If people are interested, how can people plug in? What can folks across the country, like us in California, do to support Razmiya and the anti-war 23 case?
Yeah, so the first is, you know, we're the defense committee's in the 21st century. We have a website and a Facebook and a Twitter and all that great stuff. And the website is justice4razmiya, R-A-S-M-E-A, .org. Same thing for the Twitter handle. And the Facebook page is the same as well, and it's linked through those. It's linked through both the Twitter and the website. Right now, where we're at is Razmiya's attorneys are filing for the appeal, and then the government will have time to respond. And then within the next 6 months, her case will be heard, most likely maybe around September, her appeal case. And so, you know, appeal is a little bit different than a trial. It's not this, like, longer week or 2 week process in which you mass mobilize for. It's a bit of a different game. So right now, what we're asking folks for in a real tangible way is that, like, appeal takes money, and Razmiya has the best attorneys, really, that she could possibly have. She has giants in the world of you know, U.S. political attorneys, and they're working for next to nothing. And so, for folks who can donate, they can donate right at the website, and we would definitely ask that. And then the second thing is for people to continue to do this political education campaign around Razmiya's case, draw the connections, the defense committee is more than, you know, we're all over the country, and we're more than happy to send people all over the country. And so we've sent people to California, we've sent people to New York City, we've sent people to Florida. And then we also have our own people in those areas as well that are willing to speak, willing to talk about these issues, and willing to really bring Resmia's case to these different corners and to these different communities. And so those are the two asks that we have now, is directly like for folks who could fundraise and no amount is too small to do that. And then for folks who are able to organize like a political education event around Resmia, they can reach out to us right at the website, justice4resmia.org, and we'll connect them with any resources that they need. And then the last piece that I just want to say, and I know I was thinking about it because I remember Insight a few years ago, they'd kind of written about this need. They ran into this big obstacle, and they had this need to raise a lot of money from the community. And of course, I'm paraphrasing here, right? but they were able to go back to the community and raise a bunch of money. For Asmia's case, we've had multiple fundraisers in which over $10,000, one in which $20,000 was raised. And it wasn't from like doctors and lawyers. While we have plenty of those in our community, and they do give, but it was actually from community members, and in Chicago. And our community in Chicago is largely low income, largely, you know, like service sector or that kind of work. And it was these people who really gave as much as they could, and more than they probably could have, just to support Resmia, and that's what she meant to them. And you know, the women's committee that Resmia works with has raised tens of thousands of dollars for her from the pockets of these women who, again, you know, low-income refugee women. And if they can give, and they can give tens of thousands, anyone can give.
And finally, any other thoughts you want to share in general about your community's journey in mobilizing for Resmia, freedom of speech, and Palestine?
Yeah, I mean, I think that... it's hard to think of like what's the final thought you want to end on. but I think that I think the lesson here is that we've seen a victory. Resmia's case so far has been a victory of organizing. It's an organizer's victory. The fact that she got 18 months, again, we're not happy, and we're not gonna settle for her to spend a single second in prison. But the fact that she got 18 months when the U.S. attorney and the full backing of the United States government wanted 7 years is an organizing victory. And I think that's been our biggest lesson. And it's been transformative for those of us who are organizers on the campaign for Resmia's defense. And it's been transformative for the community members that have been involved. Resmia's Women's Committee has, you know, this has really been a catalyst for them. And sometimes people learn sometimes from like reading and talking and all of these sorts of things. And people then learn lifetimes of political lessons by experiencing things. And I think that the experience around the Resmia's campaign has been, you know, a lifetime's worth of experience in this short amount of time. And that's been the lesson for us. And, you know, for those, it's an old tried and true method. But it drives the point home again that in cases of political repression, it's organizing and it's the people who win these victories. It's not pandering. It's not, you know, it's not asking nicely. It's moving our people and moving our communities to demand, you know, to demand justice for our community members and our community leaders.
Thank you again, Mohammed, for meeting with us. We will have all the resources on our website at radioautonomia.wordpress.com.
Thank you all so much, and it's a pleasure to meet you. Safe travels back.
بيلوموني لاني بالخارج وانت بالداخل عار عالما بيعترف بدور النساء المناضل طول حياتك حمل القضية انسى جنتي وانت حامل فيه اول بكاء اللي كطفل كان فيه صرخة صرخة حرية اعدام طريق قضبان آسيا انا اسير ابن اسير الطفل الوحيد بسجن نساء انولدت بالسجن وانتي لسه عايشة غار كطفل كلبشاتك كانوا العابي كنت ترضيني في الواعي فربيت واعي اكبر فرحة كانت لما طلع سلمة شوفت ابوي بس كان لي اكتر منهم ايامي تمر ايامي تروح وانا ضايق المر اسمي زي الكل اسير او معتقل بعدها بيجي اي رقم البني متوفر اي لون تاني انعدم مصير الاحرار انهطين اسلم هيك سمعت بس ما فهمت لحد ما انحبست صغير لدرجة ان لسه ملحية تسمع اي صديق اي صديق يسألني اتجوزت بفكر بشو عملت بقول الواجب بفكر بشو تركت امي ووطن حالي واذا فكرت بالوالد فيه بشاركني بنفس البرد وبنفس الخبز اليابس وبنفس الشمس مش اللي على دائرة الرسم شمسنا بمربعات صغيرة تنحسر بفكر بالندم نعم على اني انمسكت ولسه شعبي بالظلم ينحكم متخيلك ملاك فستان ابيض وطرحة ردني جنبك تأشاركك بها الفرحة خطفوني لوقت غير محدد قبل ما تلفظ بابا سمعتي حكم مؤبد عندي اليوم والغد كلمات مرادفة اسمي سجن امني عمري 20 روزنامج مفروض معزيمة استقبل فاصلة ابتسم فاصلة اعبدكم وادبك نقطة ردي الحفيد يحضن سيد الرطوبة عجلة الدادة وهم في التاريخة كنت لازم دم تغير تسجن يتحرك هالمستشفى انفضى كلهم كمامات وانا بكلبشات عالسرير ما هو في الجاذبية خايفين اطير لتأجل الفرح بحكي للصورة بحكيكي طريق صورة ريت البطولة اختيار يا ريتها مش مفروضة
about Razmea's case or to listen to more programs like this, check us out at radioautonomia.wordpress.com. The following segment is of Razmea Odeh's speech at the Insight Conference in March 2015. The speech was given a couple of months before Razmea's June appeal.
We are here at this conference to stand up for justice. And as you know, justice is not a gift or a handout that we wait for someone to give us. Justice is a human right. Justice is a human right that must be fought for and won. The way women all over the world are fighting for their rights and the rights of their people. This month we celebrate them, and I especially want to recognize the Palestinian woman who continues struggling against occupation, particularly those who are political prisoners in Israeli jails. I lived the life of a political prisoner for 10 years in Palestine, as well as 1 month of incarceration in Michigan last year. And I know how difficult it is. This recent experience gave me the opportunity to better understand the oppression that women of color, and especially black women, face in this society. I saw the racism that they face, the dehumanization, the fact that so many were incarcerated for non-violent crime, the poverty, the refusal of our government to understand the socio-economic and psychological condition that are the cause of the vast majority of alleged crime in this country. I now fully understand the prison industrial complex that Sister Angela Davis so eloquently talks and writes about every day. When I was jailed last year, the American media and the US government had already portrayed me as a criminal and a terrorist. So I had to explain who I really am to the other woman in prison. This made incarceration double hard. I had to work with the other prisoners to build a shared struggle, but it wasn't difficult for them to understand me and my struggle because we face similar oppression. From the first day in jail in Michigan, I realized that all of us had similar experience where the administration would tell us horrible stories about new women who were coming in, but these were lies. And they were telling us this to try to divide and conquer us. The prison administration also told me that the other women prisoners might attack me and that I needed protection, but that was a lie as well. I worked to build relationship with the others, but after only 1 week, they moved me away to another section. And a day later, they put me in solitary confinement where I remained for 3 weeks. That was a tough challenge, but challenges are not frightening as long as we believe in our rights and the principle that we stand for, have confidence in ourselves, and rise up together, my community and our supporters helped get me out of jail. And now, we will continue to organize to win the appeal of my conviction. All of us have dedicated our lives to the same hopes and dreams. We all stand for social justice and liberation in this country. The same way my people have dedicated their lives to the liberation of Palestine, Palestinian women are looking to this conference for your continued support of our rights, freedom for Palestinian political prisoners, the right of return, self-determination, and independence, and one single liberated state where everyone is equal. Here. I don't want them to take away my citizenship or take me away from my home and my community. I need your support because I want to continue to work with all of you to make this country and this world a better place to live and raise our families. You can join my campaign by going to the website justiceforrasmia.org, and you can tell me where to go to stand and march with you for as long as it takes to win justice and liberation for us all.
Nos dices que debemos sentarnos, pero las ideas solo pueden levantarnos, caminar, recorrer, no rendirse ni retroceder, ver, aprender como esponja absorbe. Nadie sobre todos, faltan todos, suman todos para todos, todo para nosotros. Soñamos en grande que se caiga el imperio, lo gritamos alto, no queda más remedio. Esto no es utopía, es salir de rebeldía, del baile de los que sobran, de la danza de mi mía. Levantarnos para decir ya vas. África ni América Latina se suba. Un barro con casco, con lápiz a patear el fiasco. Provocar un social terremoto en este charco. Cielo, vamos.
Resource and Organizing Center, discussing some of the harassment Arab and Palestinian activists face in their fight against political repression.
If you can just tell us a little bit about AROC and how long you've been on the collective.
Yeah, I mean, so, let's see. Well, I got started in the organization in 2005, or I think the organization, I'm not sure how far back it goes, and then in around 2007 or 2008, we changed our name to AROC, the Arab Resource and Organizing Center, and it's had, you know, been engaged in different advocacy and organizing. And right now, you know, when we became AROC, our focus really was on organizing, meaning political education, leadership development, running campaigns within the Arab community, and tying that organizing within the Arab community to broader struggles for justice and working with you know, other immigrant rights organizations, other social justice organizations, economic justice organizations, and of course, people of color and national liberation organizations.
So I guess the next question is that a lot of people believe Rasmiya's case is a byproduct of the anti-war 23. Mm-hmm. And so I was wondering if you could give a little background on that, and then as well, AROC's role in the Committee to Stop FBI Repression.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, I mean, it's interesting that you phrase it as believe that it's connected. I mean, it was never, I mean, those of us who've been involved, I mean, it was never any question, or we never thought it was anything that sort of needed explanation. But I guess, it, you know, when you listen to, when you go back and recount the timeline of events, it becomes pretty obvious. And I think that, you know, we became involved and were aware of it as soon as the raids and subpoenas happened in the fall and winter of 2010, that it wasn't just AROC, but a lot of organizations locally were really appalled at what happened and concerned about, you know, what was going on. Why were these anti-war international solidarity activists, why were their homes being raided, their property being taken? They were giving subpoenas to be called in front of a grand jury for what? And you know, what we suspected and what we still believe is true, that it was for their First Amendment their First Amendment activities. It was for being critical of foreign policy. It was for talking about social justice and social change. And a lot of people were, I mean, it was just really in shock. And so there were a number of organizations that came together. Formed a committee. It wasn't a formal coalition, but it was really a defense committee. I don't think anybody really knew how long it was going to go on. And it was people from labor unions. It was other anti-war activists. It was people of color organizations, from the Black Liberation Movement, from the Philippines Liberation Movement, and of course, the Palestine Solidarity Movement, and AROC was one of the members. And we felt very close to this work because, you know, we see the Arab American Action Network as, you know, very closely tied to us. I mean, not only because people have personal relationships to them, but because they're doing the sort of work that's very similar to what we hope to be doing, to be working in the Arab community, to be empowering people and developing their leadership, and exactly the sort of stuff that Rasmiya was doing. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's exactly what we want to do. And we've often learned from them, collaborated with them. People from AROC went out to the first USPCN and the second USPCN conferences in Chicago. And, you know, then we got to learn a lot. And, you know, the people who were on the collective learned a lot from what they were doing. And so it was you know, more than just politically important for us to be involved, but it was also personally important for a lot of people. And so then, you know, the story after that is a story of, you know, a political defense committee. And, you know, we had demonstrations, and we talked at first about, you know, what it meant to defend them. What do they need? We were on national conference calls talking about, you know, different ways of trying to figure out what was going on, why people were being attacked, how it happened, and then how it can be stopped. And, you know, there were different lines of working for it. And, you know, part of it was a legal defense, and part of it was a political defense, and that took the form of people you know, getting letters from organizations, letters from congresspeople, you know, sort of asking that the grand jury be ended, that people's properties be returned, and concern about what was going on. And We had demonstrations at San Francisco Federal Building, at the Oakland Federal Building, and you know, worked to raise awareness with the legislators that you know, as part of the legislative strategy. And then you know, as the case drew on, we had more and more time to really talk about and digest what was going on, and you know, I think a lot of us were, I don't know, somewhat aware of the history of political repression in the U.S., but it gave us time to really talk about it and analyze it. And, you know, we realized that, that this is, I mean, I think naively a lot of people, and myself at times, have thought that we were past the age of McCarthyism, that we were past the age of COINTELPRO, when we know that that's not true. And I think that, you know, I started first to learn this when there was the case of the San Francisco 8, which was very, you know, close to home here. And then I, you know, started to realize, you know, firsthand how it was going on. And then with this, it was really firsthand. And when you go back and look, there's actually, it's just a consistent history of the government using tactics like this to repress social justice movements. And it's really shocking when you go into the history. And then you start making, like, tying, seeing the thread of this political repression that goes back to, you know, Red Scare and all these laws against communism. And you can see how the case of the Los Angeles 8 fits into this, how, you know, they use these laws to attack and re-attack people for their First Amendment activities. And you see the connections to the liberation, the Black liberation movements and the Indian movements in the 60s and 70s and the 70s and the 80s. And you just... And it just all starts to come together. And then that led to a conversation of, you know, well, we also need to be prepared to defend ourselves. And really, I mean, if we need to learn from this. And we need to use this moment to bring our movements closer together and figure out how can we stop political repression. And part of that, stopping political repression, is really, you know, drawing a line with this case. So anyway, so there was the defense, and the defense then, you know, grew into, you know, other conversations. And then when they raided Carlos Montes' home, and I guess that was 2011, and at that time the case was also further unfolding and people were learning more, that brought new people into the movement, into the, you know, the defense work. We, at that point, then were able to bring Carlos Montes here into the Bay Area a couple times and draw people from, really, like, people came from Fresno and from Santa Cruz and Watsonville, and they came to see Carlos because, you know, of his connection to the Chicano movement, and people were really concerned, and he came and talked about his case, and that brought some more people into the organizing. And, you know, thankfully, his case was a victory for us. I mean, they brought some completely fake charges, which was unsurprising because that's the tactic. There's the tactic of the grand juries and the false charges. So, you know, the movement was strong then. But there was always this, you know, and the case then got dragged on and on. We had the victory with Carlos. The case dragged on and on. There was Hatem's bank accounts that got frozen, and then people's property was returned, but not Hatem's. And you know, for us, we kept our organizing going, and we kept our conversations going.
And Hatem is the director of the
one of the directors of the AAAN, yeah. And so, you know, so the question was always like, well, what are they doing? And then when they, you know, charged Dresmia, it was... That's why it wasn't a surprise to us. I mean, this was just the next development of the case. And it fit so neatly in with the pattern of what they've done in the past. And it's what they do to Carlos Montes, and it's what they do with grand juries. They want to squash First Amendment activities. They want to squash, you know, people just from speaking out. And so they do it any way they can. And grand juries are one way of doing that. Grand juries are one way of, you know, catching people in traps and, you know, finding small inconsistencies and then charging them with, with perjury and so the fact that they, the charges, the fake charges against Carlos Montes were sort of, you know, a precursor to them having fake charges brought against Resmia. And so it's all like, when they charged Resmia, it was a surprise because I didn't know, you know, in my realm of the defense work, Resmia wasn't on my radar. I was sort of concerned with the people who had actually been subpoenaed, but it was not a surprise. It's in the end, you know, what I think this is they were looking to attack and silence people. First, the anti-war groups who they initially infiltrated. I mean, we should go back to that, the infiltrator that they put in the anti-war groups, and then the international solidarity movement people who were subpoenaed, and finally, the attacks on leaders, and Carlos Montes was one, and Al Resmi is another. Who are leaders of important movements that are organizing people, empowering people. That's not what, you know, people in power want. So it wasn't a surprise to us that they made up some false charges it seems to me like it's an act of desperation. They want to attack in any way they can, and that was one thing that, like, they're like, well, maybe we can do this, and that's what they did.
Okay, thank you. One other question. So is AROC still continuing with, or what form of resistance or organizing is AROC involved in now to keep up with the developments of the case?
Yeah. What we're doing now is we still have a loose network of people who are committed to taking action. And I think right now what we've been doing is, you know, keeping involved with the people, keeping in touch with the people in Chicago, and trying to find ways that we can support as needed. I think that because Resmia's case is a little bit different than the sort of demonstrations that we were used to having at the federal building, at federal buildings that don't, you know, always seem as effective. And we've been trying to take the lead from, you know, what they feel they need. And we've had a number of fundraisers, and we've had a number of awareness events specifically about Resmia. And now what we are constantly doing is Resmia is an integral part of our work. Talking about the case and talking about Resmia's situation is an integral part of our work, that whenever we're, you know, going to talk, for example, at May Day, the issue of what's going on with Resmia is at the forefront. So, you know, as much as, you know, that there's the activities that her defense committee calls for, we, you know, are ready to support them.
Thank you so much, Sammy.
To listen to and download past Radio Autonomía segments and shows, including the individual segments of this special program, visit our website at radioautonomia.wordpress.com. If you have any questions, comments, suggestions, or want to get involved, shoot us a message as radioautonomia@gmail.com. You can find more information about the case and other resources mentioned in the interviews online as well.